I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Welcome to Radio Times. It was shocking by almost any standard. Yesterday, President Trump defended the white supremacists carrying Confederate banners and Nazi flags in Charlottesville last weekend and said protesters on the left were equally culpable for the violent confrontations that led to the death of a young woman and the injury of 19 others.
Mr. President, are you putting what you're calling the alt-left and white supremacists on the same moral plane?
I'm not putting anybody on a moral plane. What I'm saying is this. You had a group on one side and you had a group on the other, and they came at each other with clubs, and it was vicious, and it was horrible, and it was a horrible thing to watch. But there is another side. There was a group on this side, you can call them the left, you've just called them the left, that came violently attacking the other group. So you can say what you want, but that's the way it is.
You said there was hatred, there was violence on both sides.
I think there's blame. Yes, I think there's blame on both sides. You look at both sides. I think there's blame on both sides, and I have no doubt about it, and you don't have any doubt about it either.
And
if you reported it accurately, you would say.
They showed up in Charlottesville to protest, and you had some very bad people in that group.
But you also had people that were very fine people on both sides.
The protesters were a mix of white supremacist groups and were in the city to oppose the removal of a statue of Robert E. Lee. Trump questioned whether the statues of George Washington and Thomas Jefferson were next. David Duke, former KKK leader, tweeted, "Thank you, President Trump, for your honesty and courage to tell the truth." White nationalist leader Richard Spencer tweeted, "Trump's statement was fair and down to earth." Today on Radio Times, we get reaction to Trump's combative Q&A session on Tuesday. Also, the roots, supporters, growth, and political clout of white supremacist groups. Joining us is A.C. Thompson. He's a staff reporter for ProPublica, has been reporting on hate violence and neo-Nazis since the 1990s, and he was in Charlottesville. Over the weekend, he helped to organize the Documenting Hate Project, bringing together more than 100 news organizations to report on bigotry and hate crimes. And A.C. Thompson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. Also with us is David Cunningham. He's a professor of sociology at Washington University, wrote a book called Klansville, USA, The Rise and Fall of the Civil Rights Era Ku Klux Klan. And David Cunningham, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me.
David, let me begin with you. And I'm trying to think of a modern president. I know President Wilson showed Birth of a Nation at the White House. That was 100 years ago. But I'm trying to think of a modern president who defended people. Certainly they have the right to carry Nazi flags and Confederate flags, but to defend the ideology of these racist groups. Do we have any other president who has done something similar?
I think it's difficult to find a precedent at the presidential level over the last 60, 70, 80 years. To me, I think the closest precedent of people of some level of power would be thinking about segregationist governors in civil rights era America. And one of the things that you see, what people are referring to as a false equivalence that President Trump offered between saying that this is an issue of both sides coming to this and contributing to this violence. This is exactly the same sort of strategy that segregationist governors like George Wallace would have used in the 1960s. People understood that Wallace, behind the scenes, was opening up space for the Klan. But what people don't often understand is that he wasn't actively promoting the Klan publicly. Mm-hmm. He would distance himself. But the way he would do it is very similar to what President Trump did, where he would say, what we have here is a problem where we have extremists on both sides. And what Wallace would refer to would be the KKK and the NAACP as the equivalent extremists. And the problem there was that he would conflate and allied the ideology of particular groups and the goals of other sorts of groups. And it would give him this room where he could say that he's distancing himself from the violence per se, but then to create this equivalence across ideology of these groups. And I think, to me, that is the closest equivalent we can find in the modern era.
A.C., you were in Charlottesville over the weekend reporting on the rally, the demonstrations, the violence for ProPublica. Is the president correct saying that both sides were equally culpable for the violence that happened?
I mean, there is some element of truth to what the president has to say, and that pains me to say that. But you know, there were absolutely were people in the anti-racist protests, in the anti-fascist protests, who physically attacked neo-Nazis and neo-Confederates and white supremacists. That's true.
Right.
And the more nuanced understanding of this is, the truth of the matter is, the white supremacists were basically kicking the butts of the leftists and the anti-racists. They were dominating the situation, and the minority of people, the small minority of people who physically decided that it's time to punch a Nazi or were inflamed and outraged when they saw Nazi and white supremacist icons marching down the street, Nazi flags and so forth. That was a small group, and they were honestly fairly ineffective in doing that. What I would say is what really happened throughout the weekend is there were white supremacists who were terrorizing everybody in the city. So, you know, they terrorized people in my journalistic group, the team that I was with. They terrorized people at the cafe I went to and demanded that the cafe open early and serve the Nazis. They terrorized people up and down Charlottesville. And what you had, it was a group that was overwhelmingly comprised of very hardcore white supremacists. They were not like Confederate history buffs hanging out with the Nazis. This was neo-Nazis, white nationalists, white supremacists, neo-Confederates all together. There was not like a core of just right-minded conservatives out there. And on the other side, you had clergy, assorted sort of anti-racist folks, and a small group of people who said, you know, if the Nazis show up here, you know, maybe we should physically run them out. But it was not the scene that the president has painted at all.
And AC, you wrote about this, and other people have questioned, and we could do a whole hour on it, which I don't want to do because there's so much else to talk about. But there was a question about where was the police? Did they let this fighting and violence go on without the proper kind of intervention?
You know, what we have seen at the new wave of white supremacist rallies across the country is we've seen the police taking a pretty hands-off tactic, right? So that happened in Sacramento, California last year. 10 people were stabbed. That has happened in Berkeley and Portland. And here over the weekend, it was pretty remarkable to me. The park was cordoned off with metal police barricades, and there was only one way into the park. And if police had wanted to, they could have said, hey, if you want to come into the park as a white supremacist, you're going to have to give us your club, your shield, your pepper spray, your gun, your knife. And they didn't do that. And look, that's not infringing on people's free speech or free assembly rights. If you say, hey, you know, you want to come to a public place, you can't bring a weapon. That's well within proper policing tactics. They didn't do that. They didn't keep the group separated. And I will tell you that over and over and over again, I watched incredibly violent physical confrontations occur with absolutely no intervention by the police. And I'll tell you, in one case, I watched as a group of gray-haired, very mainstream, liberal, anti-racist types said, hey, you know, we don't like Nazis. And a line of young white supremacists lined up in front of them in military formation, ran at them, absolutely pummeled them. And they did all this as the police watched and stood by.
Wow.
Once the white supremacists had moved on and kept marching, the police came out from behind their barricades and asked if anybody needed help.
David, let me get you back in on the conversation. You have written about the Ku Klux Klan, and of course there were a mix of groups like the Klan, neo-Nazis, newer groups that have names that we are learning, Vanguard America, Identity Europa. Is it important to separate what these groups are? And I ask also about what the KKK is today. We heard David Duke speaking on Saturday. He tweeted about the president's comments yesterday. What do these groups want? And are they in some ways connected to each other?
Well, it's a good question. It's certainly something that's changed a lot over the last couple of years even.
you know, the KKK from the 1970s onward largely have held some symbolic cachet, meaning that they were the most visible white supremacist outfit. They were kind of the original organized vigilantist white supremacist group from dating from right after the Civil War. And their rituals and their symbols are really resonant. People understand what they're seeing when you see things that are associated with the KKK. That said, from the 70s onward, the KKK has been a relatively marginal player in the white supremacist field. You know, the KKK is incredibly factionalized, so it doesn't even really make sense to talk about the Klan. We're dealing with a few dozen organizations, and they're self-styled. It's an entrepreneurial opportunity oftentimes. They tend to be marginal and very small in terms of numbers. You know, and what we had seen from the 80s onward is an increased blending between the Klan and other kinds of groups, neo-Nazi groups, certain kinds of militia groups. And then what we're seeing over the last couple of years is a new generation of leadership, really, that is kind of refashioning the entire extreme racist right in a variety of ways. And these become really important extensions of what's been happening earlier. And one of the things that I think is important is that what we saw during the Obama administration was actually a fairly sharp increase in the number of groups that were being formed, militia groups, anti-Muslim groups. But it's created a whole new infrastructure for this movement to flourish. And what we're seeing under Trump isn't something that is a Trump phenomenon in isolation. What we're really seeing is groups that are benefiting from the organization that preceded them during the Obama administration. And we see we move from organization to having an infrastructure for the kind of coordinated action that we saw in Charlottesville.
So is white supremacist, not to get too linguistic here, but does white supremacist then describe what these groups want? They want a white America. They don't want minorities. They don't want Jews.
Yeah, I mean, they're certainly drawing on the full kind of repertoire of traditional veins of white supremacy. So we see in Charlottesville, I mean, imagery that we would expect to see potentially in this world with swastikas and things like that. We also see, you know, the kind of chanting where Jews will not replace us, the sort of anti-Semitism as this layer on top of the particular grievances that might be associated with immigration, might be associated with Confederate heritage, might be associated with outright racism. But you see all of these kind of themes and tropes that are coming together under this umbrella. But in terms of the rhetoric and the ideology, when you break it down to its foundations, we're not seeing something new here in terms of something that's distinct from prior waves and generations of white supremacy.
And I do want to pick up with the both of you. We need to take a very short break talking about the violence in Charlottesville over the weekend, the white supremacist movement, talking with David Cunningham. He's a professor of sociology at Washington University, wrote a book called Klansville, USA. A.C. Thompson with us as well, staff reporter for ProPublica. He was in Charlottesville over the weekend, has been reporting on hate violence and neo-Nazi groups since the 1990s. And you can join our conversation calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Questions or comments, join the conversation. And we have a third guest waiting in the wings. We'll be right back. And that's a clip from Vice News. They were in Charlottesville, Virginia, over the weekend. Joining us now is Christian Piccellini. He became a Nazi skinhead leader in Chicago when he was a teenager more than 20 years ago. He renounced and left the movement when he was in his early 20s, went on to co-found Life After Hate, helping to rehabilitate members of hate groups like himself. His book is titled Romantic Violence, Memoirs of an American Skinhead. And we asked him to join us to help us understand what attracts a person to an extremist group. Christian Piccellini, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
So I'm wondering how you think members of extremist groups are interpreting what the president said yesterday.
Well, I think it was loud and clear what the president said yesterday as he denounced the KKK and neo-Nazis and white nationalists, but he defended the alt-right. In my experience, having been in the movement for 8 years, 30 years ago, there is no difference other than the packaging if we're talking about the KKK, neo-Nazis, or the alt-right. So, you know, to me, I believe it emboldened even more how they feel and how we're going to see them react in public from now on.
So, I mean, it looks like there are more demonstrations and I should say counter demonstrations planned for the next couple of weekends. Do you anticipate even larger protests from these groups looking ahead?
Unfortunately, I do think it's going to get a little worse before it gets better. I think that they've got the momentum now. They feel as though they're supported at the highest office to do what they want to do, and that's terrorize communities. So I do think that we're going to see a lot more of this happening in the future. But make no mistake, this is something that's been happening for decades already. I write in my book a chapter about a rally that was almost identical to the one that happened in Charlottesville. We've been sweeping this under the rug for so many years, and now it's poking its head back out. And while people want to push it back into the sewers where it came from, I think that the proper way to handle this is to really invite it out, and we need to have this conversation. And I can tell you from all the folks that I've worked with to help disengage from the far-right movement that receiving compassion from the people they least deserve it from, when they least deserve it, is what transforms them. I don't know that anybody in the history of the United States has ever had their racist views changed by being punched in the face.
Well, that's a really interesting comment, because I think the impulse is to shut these people down. But what I hear you saying, Christian, is that we need to listen to them and talk to them and try to understand what attracts them to these groups. And I'm curious about what you think that is. And I ask, the little that we know about James Alex Fields, and he's been accused of second-degree murder and the death of the young woman on Saturday, Heather Heyer, who's being buried today. Mm-hmm. The little that we know is that his mother had called 911 a couple of times. She felt threatened by her own son. Is that a bit of an indication about who we're dealing with here?
Yeah, you know, I can't tell you how many parents I speak to on a daily basis who describe the exact situation of that man in that car and how concerned they are with the habits of their sons, daughters, loved ones who, you know, feel marginalized and are now starting to become very integrated into this alt-right movement. They're starting to read copies of Mein Kampf. They're starting to talk about white genocide. And I hear this over and over and over again about how afraid parents are that their son or daughter may end up being the next Dylann Roof or the next Wade Michael Page. But I also want to say that I don't believe that ideology is what radicalizes people. I think it's the fundamental search for three human needs, and that's a search for identity, community, and purpose. If there's something broken underneath that, and I call them potholes, and it mm-hmm. could be trauma, abuse, unemployment, addiction, mental illness, if something like that exists under that, when you're searching for your identity, community, and purpose, we tend to look for those in negative pathways. So to parents, to anybody who is concerned about somebody, I would say, you know, make sure that people's needs are attended to, especially when dealing with mental health conditions, support people so that they don't have to step in those potholes and deviate their path from the one that they're intended on.
I know you wrote a whole book about this. Just one question. How and why did you get out of this movement?
You know, I began to receive compassion from the people I least deserved it from when I least deserved it. For the first time in my life, I had the opportunity to have a meaningful interaction with the people that I thought I hated. And then once that happened, I just couldn't reconcile my prejudice or my hate any longer.
But do you think you were ready to hear that there was something inside of you that was more open to that? Or was it just that people finally were kind to you?
You know, I kept myself out of those situations. I kept people outside of my social network on purpose. And because I was so isolated from them, I never had the opportunity to understand that they weren't the demons or the parasites that I had in my head that I thought they were. You know, but to be honest, for 8 years while I was involved in this movement, from the time I was 14 until I was 22, every single day I had a doubt about what I was involved in because I wasn't raised that way. It wasn't part of my family DNA. In fact, my parents were Italian immigrants who came from Italy in the mid-1960s, and they were often the victims of prejudice. So almost 2-1, and I've spoken to hundreds, if not thousands, of people who've joined this movement and have managed to get out. Every single one of them, to a T, says that they joined because they wanted something to belong to, And when they got out, eventually, if they were lucky enough, it's because of the kindness of people that they thought that they hated.
Final question to you, Christian. Do you see this then as an opportunity, what we saw in Charlottesville? And of course, it's happened in other parts of the country over decades, many years in this country. But also this conversation that we're having now, is this an opportunity for this country?
I think it's an opportunity if America and its citizens choose to do something with it. I'm not confident that anything is going to be done at the highest levels. In fact, I think that the opposite is happening, that it's actually going to get worse because of the rhetoric that's coming out of the administration. So this is a call to American people to stand up for justice, to stand up for equal rights, and to stand up for your brothers and sisters, regardless of who they are, what religion they are, or what color skin they have. This is a time when Americans must stand together against something that's been a dark stain on our country since the very beginning.
Christian Piccolini, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Former white supremacist, co-founded a group called Life After Hate and wrote a book called Romantic Violence, Memoirs of an American Skinhead. A.C. Thompson, still with us, staff reporter for ProPublica. He was in Charlottesville over the weekend reporting for ProPublica and has been reporting on hate violence and neo-Nazis since the 1990s. David Cunningham, professor of sociology at Washington University. He wrote a book called Klansville, USA, The Rise and Fall of the Civil Rights Era KKK. Or Ku Klux Klan. We've got calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. AC, let me segue from what Christian was describing, both himself and the people that he knows that have been attracted to these extremist groups. You wrote about just, and you can see from the video and the images from Charlottesville, how many young men we saw in Charlottesville. What does that tell us about the organizations that are operating today?
Well, you know, first off, I want to say that Christian's point about people seeking some sort of community and some sort of purpose, that was very much, very much in effect in Charlottesville.
You can see that.
Absolutely. You kept meeting young men, and as you said, overwhelmingly young men, who it seemed like they had finally found a community. They had found people to hang out with. They had found camaraderie. And in this highly mediated, a really sort of splintered, atomized society we're living in, this was the purpose, this was the bond, this was the sort of family that they had been searching for. And I think that's an important, important point. These groups that we were seeing there, incredibly organized, very efficient, very impressive in their tactical acumen, I would say steps up, at least several steps up from their predecessors in the white supremacist movement, and a lot of new groups. You know, I would say, in my mind, there were some, old guard groups. There were some, a few Klan people. There were a few members of, there was a significant contingent of members of the League of the South, which is an older neo-Confederate group. There was a group of members of the National Socialist Movement, which goes back to the 1970s. But overwhelmingly, it was new groups, groups that had formed in the last 5 years that were leading this movement. So we were talking about Identity Europa, Traditionalist Workers Party.
These are
the new groups that were out there and really were at the front of the movement.
David, I have some questions for you about the KKK, but first let me get Clay from Philadelphia to join our conversation. Clay, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
A couple of things. If I wanted to join ISIS, I would be arrested. How are these groups not organized? Not outlawed as terrorist organizations. Mm-hmm. And number two, why aren't the people that went down there to confront them? Why are they not considered freedom fighters? Because somewhere you raise your hand in the military to say, "I will take care of America's enemies, foreign and domestic." These people are taking care of America's enemies, domestic. Because if you don't believe in "We hold these truths to be self-evident," then you're an enemy of America. So why aren't these people called freedom fighters? And why do these groups get to exist? And why aren't they outlawed?
Well, that's an interesting question, Clay. And I'll put that first to you, David Cunningham. Are we talking about terrorist organization, terrorist groups in the United States?
Sure. I appreciate that question and that viewpoint, because I think we absolutely are dealing with groups that are aligned with terrorist ends and have used terrorist means And I also think if we're thinking about historical parallels, what AC was describing about the kind of hands-off policing approach, to me, is quite evocative of what we saw through the early 1960s against the KKK. You know, what it evokes are FBI agents taking notes across the street while civil rights activists are being beaten badly and hurt badly. What it also evokes are Klan rallies in the first half of the 1960s where the state highway patrol and the state police decide what's important is to monitor these kinds of things and make sure that order is maintained. And so they're doing things like directing traffic. And what it looks like is that the police are in some ways organizing and sponsoring the events, and they're not doing anything to prevent things that are either symbolic of or acts of terrorism being perpetrated. And so when we think about the decline of the Klan in the second half of the 1960s, the major difference between, say, 1964 and 1966 is that there were a set of congressional investigations into the KKK in 1965 and 6, and stemming from that, there was a coordinated call and mandate for a policing response that wasn't just about monitoring sites to try to maintain order, but was about proactively trying to limit the ability of terrorist organizations from organizing. Mm. And that is what really hindered those groups' ability to maintain a mass presence in the way that they had before. And, you know, so when we see the kind of police approach that AC was describing in Charlottesville, I think, you know, that is something that could be discussed in that broader light.
Well, you know, I'm thinking of the ACLU defending the Nazis' right to demonstrate to protest in Skokie, Illinois, and the ACLU upheld their right to do that. So people, even if we hate what they have to say, David, people have a right to express hate, racism, anti-Semitism, homophobia.
Certainly, the Virginia ACLU went to court in this case as well.
AC, go ahead. I'm sorry. Say that again.
I would say the Virginia ACLU went to court in this case as well to protect the right to free speech and assembly for this group this past weekend.
And I agree that that's an important balance, and I wasn't implying that these groups should never be able to gather in any sort of setting. But the idea is the police, depending on the type of event, have a whole array of tactics that they use to control crowds, to control space, and those really affect the contours and the possibilities for what happens during the particular events. And so, short of prohibiting a gathering, there are all sorts of ways that gathering can be impacted, recognizing the particular ends and ideologies as that will interact with the dynamic of the event. And it just seems like there is a whole spectrum of policing actions here, and it's not just a matter of should this group be allowed to gather or should it not.
Fair enough. Let me get Joe from Sewell, New Jersey, to join our conversation. Hi, Joe. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, I guess I just have a very brief comment, and then your guests can respond. But the Bible is explicit about loving what is right and standing for mercy and hating what is evil. And part of hating evil is to stand against it and confront it. And the fact that the president was unable to delineate between these very clearly drawn lines is dumbfounding to me. And where are the voice of the evangelical leadership? Jerry Falwell's son, specifically, could call any of the major news outlets and they would put him on their show and let him stand up against the president of the United States being unable to speak out clearly when these lines were drawn for everyone to see. And one last point.
Sure.
The fact that the president is unable to distinguish clearly, at least in my mind, and the fact that he has access to nuclear weapons is a bit concerning. And I'll take any comments.
Sure, Joe. Thanks for calling into Radio Times. AC, you have been covering hate groups and hate violence for a number of years now. And it is, I believe, a test of the country, but certainly a test for the president and his supporters about what they are going to do. Now, clearly, some people have spoken out, including Republicans and some conservatives, against the president. But do you see this as a test?
You know, it shouldn't be. It's not that hard, right? I mean, I think your caller's exactly correct. This is not really that hard. But I'll tell you what's important is for the far right groups, they have moved past Trump in a lot of ways. You know, they saw him in some ways as a catalyst, as a propellant, as someone who was finally speaking about the rights of white folks. And they've moved past him. They want somebody who's more radical than him to run this country with an iron fist. But they also understand his messaging. They know at some point he's going to have to say, oh, David Duke, I disavow you. Oh, KKK, I disavow you. But the delay in doing that and the qualification and the back and forth, they are loving this. And they are taking this as a sign that they're on the right path and that they have a friend in the White House. Absolutely.
David, about a minute before our break here, but are we giving these groups what it is that they crave, which is attention?
Well, certainly we are giving them attention, and that is something that they crave. And, you know, I think the fact that that cycle extends, you know, through the dynamic that you're describing with the president being unwilling to unequivocally condemn what we see here is, you know, is also empowering in lots of ways, and exactly as AC just said. And I think there are aspirations that these groups have, but they certainly see the moment that they're in as a window of opportunity. You know, this is, it's not that they're operating with impunity, but they're certainly operating with less unequivocal opposition than they might have in almost any other era over the last certainly half century in terms of the kinds of action that they're promoting.
We are talking about white supremacist groups, their roots, supporters, growth, political power, what happened in Charlottesville, Virginia last weekend, and what the president said yesterday, talking with David Cunningham. That's a voice you just heard. He's a professor of sociology at Washington University, author of a book called Klansville, USA, The Rise and Fall of the Civil Rights Era Ku Klux Klan. Also with us, A.C. Thompson, staff reporter for ProPublica, has been reporting on hate violence and neo-Nazis since the 1990s. And he helped to organize the Documenting Hate Project, bringing together news organizations to report on bigotry and hate crimes. And he did cover the white supremacist rally in Charlottesville. We are continuing our conversation. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Let me get Phil from Downingtown to join our conversation. Phil, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
I grew up in Virginia, and I want to, first of all, repudiate all of the ideals of the alt-right and the people that were protesting against or for white supremacy. But my second thing is that the statues are not symbols of hate. It's the people that are protesting that are, you know, have their flags and their torches. They're the symbols of hate. The statues of Confederate soldiers from 200 years ago or 150 years ago have little to do with the ideals that they expose today.
Well, Phil, let me give our guests a chance to respond to that. AC, you were in Charlottesville, so you know where that statue of Robert E. Lee is, what it looks like. Do you agree with our callers saying that statues are different from what we saw demonstrated on the streets of Charlottesville?
You know, let's be real. And by the way, I grew up in Virginia as well. I think it's a far reach to say that the symbols aren't symbols of white supremacy. They absolutely are symbols of white supremacy. That's what white supremacy is about, owning other people. And that's what the Civil War era is all about. That's what the Confederate States were about. I mean, I just think you have to be real about this. And I think the real truth is that we have not had the sort of deep conversation we need to have about reconciliation, about being honest about the past. I think Mitchell Andrew, the mayor of New Orleans, put it pretty poignantly and appropriately when he said, hey, look, these statues that are all across the country were part of a plan to rebrand the history of the Confederate South and to make it look less noxious and less awful than it was. And it's important for us in this moment, whether we're journalists, whether we're activists, whether we're academics or just average people, to fully acknowledge what that history was and that we should not rebrand and whitewash, excuse the pun, that Confederate history.
Well, David, let me put a couple of things to you. And as AC was talking, I was thinking about Nikki Haley removed the Confederate flag from the Capitol in South Carolina after that horrible massacre at the church. And many of these statues, as I understand it, including the one in Charleston, excuse me, in Charlottesville, were built around the turn of the 20th century. So what were these statues about?
Yeah, that's an important observation to make. You know, one of the things that we often elide here is the distinction between statues that are memorials to, say, so Confederate war dead and monuments to something that's broader. And when we think about when these statues were placed, exactly as you're saying, the two periods where we've seen a lot of activity there are during the years in the early 20th century where Jim Crow was being solidified in the South and that broader ethic was sort of prevalent in a variety of ways nationally. And during the Civil Rights era in the 50s and 60s, you see, again, the kind of rebirth of an embracing of the Confederate battle flag. And so what these are really are monuments to the lost cause, which is a revisionist history of what the Civil War was about. And that revisionist history says, well, the Civil War wasn't really about defending slavery. It was about this broader way of life and defending states' rights and all these sorts of things. And so when we talk about these statues as in a benign way representing history, what we're neglecting there is thinking about the fact what they're really about is an ideological view of what Civil War history can and should be. And so it's important, I think, to think of these as monuments to that lost cause and not memorials to particular individuals that sacrificed their lives to that cause.
Essentially declaring war on the United States in defense of slavery. Do I have that right, David?
Yes.
That's what the Civil War was about. So interestingly, the president said yesterday, well, if you're going to take down the statue of Robert E. Lee, is Jefferson next or Washington next? Because they own slaves, and indeed they did. AC, I'm curious about how that plays out and what the president was saying. What you think he was saying.
Yeah, well, again, to just keep it real here, what the president was saying is exactly what the white supremacists in Charlottesville were saying. I was at their nighttime rally on Friday night when they had hundreds and hundreds of people marching Klan style with torches. And you know where they went? They went to the Thomas Jefferson statue at the University of Virginia. And that is because they think all white history is under attack. The Thomas Jefferson statue is coming down next. The George Washington statue is coming down next. And the line that they have about history, about what it means to be white, about feeling under assault, that's the same exact line that the president trotted out. And I think it's important to note. I mean, also, I just want to point out on that sort of theme,
sure.
You know, these folks, they feel that they are under threat. You know, they throw out the notion of white genocide, that whites are becoming a minority in this country and will eventually be stamped out, that their history is being demolished and so forth. And I think when you're in that mindset, when you feel that you're the victim of an ongoing genocide, that allows you to have the mental space to act very dramatically and in very extreme fashions. And I think that's exactly what we saw with what appears to have been a terror attack in Charlottesville with the car incident. I mean, we should not be surprised. If you think you're the victim of genocide, you will strike out in very aggressive ways.
Let me just pick up on that and then we'll get back to our callers. David, from your perspective and from your look at the history of the Klan, does that represent a particular point of view? Not that you're just going to be a minority in this country if you're a white person, but you're not going to exist. It's going to be genocide.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a long-running theme in white supremacist circles. And that sense of threat that really motivates people is very distinctively associated with that kind of mobilization when we think about white supremacy. And I think AC is exactly right in the sense that that breeds not only a different kind of mindset, but a different kind of action. And so the sense that leaders can easily be thinking about the sorts of escalation of action because the situation is so dire. And that can be manufactured because a lot of the followers, again, are really coming into this because they feel that sense of threat. And so it becomes compelling to say, well, we can push back against this. We can act against this. And the more that rhetoric gets inflamed, the more it points to extreme and potentially terroristic actions as a way to try to remedy this supposed change that's coming forth.
Let me get Nancy from Pennsylvania to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Nancy. Go ahead. You're on the air. That would be number three in line. Yeah, go ahead, Nancy.
Hi.
Hi there.
I would just like to hear a comment about, it's not just an issue of monuments that people walk by every day and try to ignore. It's the fact that we as a society are permitting these things to happen. The Manufacturing Council that the president has pulled together, a number of people of good conscience dropped out yesterday.
Right.
But, for example, the head of Walmart said, you know, while he disagrees with what Trump said and with what happened in Charlottesville, he thinks it's important to maintain a dialogue for the sake of American manufacturing. Is that not what German manufacturing company had said about Hitler as they were touting Hitler's purported abilities to bring Germany back to financial success? This permitting this stuff to happen is causing these people to think it's okay.
Well, I guess there is a real question about whether working on the inside is going to make a difference, or whether walking away is going to have a bigger impact. David or AC, either of you want to respond to Nancy's comment? No, that's fair. No, that's
well, okay. I could just say quickly.
This is AC. AC, go ahead.
Oh, sure.
No, go ahead. No, I'm sorry. I'm getting my voices mixed up here. I think that was you, David. Go ahead.
Yeah, I would just say quickly. I mean, to integrate that comment with some of the discussion before, you know, I think one of the things that this is speaking to, when people of conscience or people who are not part of this world are being able to evaluate the degree to which, you know, what we can stand for and what we can't, we have a very stunted historical memory here that we can draw upon as a common foundation to have a dialogue. And this is something that in the U.S. we certainly haven't reconciled and haven't been able to have a full dialogue about. And I think there are organizations and campaigns that are working exactly in that direction. I'm guessing a lot of listeners are familiar with the Equal Justice Initiative, and they've been engaged in studies of the lynching era. They're working on resistance to civil rights. And the idea is that we understand just how intertwined that kind of resistance was, not only with these extremist movements, but in terms of what a lot of mainstream folks were doing. And so the idea is that, you know, for us to understand what's happening in Charlottesville last week, what's happening in New Orleans over the last few months as people get very charged about these monuments, is really understanding what is this broader context that's a thread through American history here. And this idea of creating a restorative space where we can actually try to work towards a foundation where people can be engaged, or where compassion can actually be expressed in a way that can be heard, seems incredibly important.
And that's underscoring what Christian Piccellini was telling us earlier in the hour. Let me read some of the comments. We've gotten an email from Paul. It really has come down to law enforcement. These towns have to know there will be trouble. The hands-off approach will just lead to more deaths. A tweet from Eric: President Trump didn't defend their ideology. He defended their character. An email from Francis: why don't we see similar ethno-nationalist fringe groups in the U.S. non-white populations? Are they there? Do we not see them? A text: so we know that the Confederacy wants to keep slavery in place. Could you please ask your guests what the Confederacy wanted with respect to Jewish people? And there certainly was, AC, a fair amount of anti-Semitism that we heard coming out of these groups in Charlottesville. Do you understand, looking at some of these hate groups, how anti-Semitism is a part of this?
You know, I think it was an early tip off that what we were seeing was really an extension of previous white supremacist movements, because the sort of in the American extremist scene, the conspiracy theories around Jews, about Jewish control of the media, Jewish control of the government, et cetera, these have been going on for a century, and they're a hoary old trope that's been trotted out generation after generation. And what you saw with this new era of white supremacists is it sort of starts off with, we don't like Muslims because they're terrorists. We don't like Mexicans because they're stealing our jobs. And like the president said, they're criminals and rapists. We don't like this person and that person. And very quickly, it moved into anti-Semitism. And that, I believe, is pulling it directly from the sort of previous literature and the previous thinking of the older white supremacist movements. Big anti-Semitic current in this current group, big anti-Semitic themes. And I think that we have seen a significant rise in hate violence, hate crimes, and vandalism directed at Jews in America over the last year.
David, anything you want to add to that?
Well, I would concur with everything that was just said. And, you know, I'd say that conspiratorial line going back in white supremacist ideology is, you know, largely around, you know, among the many flaws in white supremacist logic is this idea that to promote white superiority, you really have to diminish the perceived capacity of other people who don't fit into that, you know, quote unquote, white world. And but then you're faced with situations where people of color are accomplishing things in very sophisticated ways. You know, you look at the civil rights movement, this was the major dynamic, and incredibly creative ways the civil rights movement was making advances. And so this conspiratorial line that tends to center on the Jews, so this anti-Semitic line was really about creating a conspiracy to say, well, the people that we see on the streets here are not capable of what we see them doing. There's got to be something that lies behind that, that provides the impetus. And so the idea is that people of color are now tools of something broader, and the easiest thing to say what that broader conspiracy is centered on is going to be involving anti-Semitism.
And we're almost out of time here, but are we also seeing, and I'm thinking in the 1920s was a time of great turmoil, and I think, David, the KKK had membership in the millions at that time, but is it when times of change and dislocation and insecurity and confusion and fear that gives rise to these kinds of organizations that are attractive to people who are scared about the future?
I mean, I think that's exactly right. And when we have periods of economic instability, of political instability, of great change, where there are people who have had a particular expectations around their standing in life, where that becomes shaky, that's exactly when you see the appeal of these kinds of threat-based movements, where people can say, you know, your rightful way of life will exist no longer if you just let this happen. And when times are unstable, that sort of rhetoric really can resonate. And you're exactly right. In the 20s, the Klan was in the millions. It was a national movement. It wasn't just confined to the South. And that was exactly that kind of period. And so you saw a lot of anti-Catholic sentiment, anti-Semitic sentiment, anti-immigration, as well as racism, and a look back to the Confederate era as this sort of lost cause.
AC, we're almost out of time here. Any final words you want to say before we say goodbye?
No, I think those were really, really great points. I mean, I think the last final words that I would just say is that, you know, we need to take this very seriously. We need to be aware of it. We need to not underestimate these groups. These are not dumb people. These are not a bunch of rednecks. These are smart, well-organized people, and we need to be aware of that and really be thinking how to respond to smart, well-organized people.
AC Thompson, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times. Thank you, AC.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Staff reporter with ProPublica, David Cunningham, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you very much.
Professor of Sociology at Washington University, author of Klansville, USA. An email from Peter just came in after the press conference in New York on Tuesday. Trump was asked if he would be going to Charlottesville, where violence erupted over the weekend. Trump answered by bragging he owned a winery and house in the area. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.